is because of the soldiers, that the shrine itself, its white dome shining like a second moon at night, has changed its meaning. The shrine, the relic, and the soldiers together are part of what makes Kashmir both heaven on earth, as it has often been called, and the most dangerous place in the world.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. Religious relics are looked on by many as a strange tradition from another time. Why, they wonder, would anyone revere an old bone, a piece of hair, or even a shriveled tongue? But writer Peter Manceau was drawn to what he calls the hidden histories of relics. So Manceau traveled around the world collecting stories about relics and the people who pray to them, take care of them, covet them. He writes of his adventures and the insights he unearthed in his new book, Rag and Bone, A Journey Among the World's Holy Dead. Manceau discussed his book at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. on April 4th.
Thank you all for being here. Rag and Bone is essentially a book about stories. It is, on one level, it's a book about dismembered toes, bits of fingers chopped off, a shriveled bit of tongue appears at the start of the book, but it is not a book about death, despite the skeleton on the cover. It is, as Abby said, it's a book about movement, which is a book about life. And another alternate title to Rag and Bone, and the subtitle, A Journey Among the World's Holy Dead, might have been A Journey Among the World's Holy Dead and the People Who Love Them. Because I've always been much more interested in the lives that revolve around religious objects than in the religious objects themselves. And approaching those lives, one needs to pay attention to the objects, but it's always the very human stories that are of interest to me, less so than the theology. The theology is part of human lives, but it's the human lives that's most interesting to me. Because it is a book about stories, I thought I should start off by telling you a few stories that appear in the book in various forms. And the first one Abby mentioned just very briefly, and just to give you a bit more detail about it. In the 13th century, there was a bishop in England. His name was Hugh. He was called Hugh of Lincoln. Hugh of Lincoln, it seems, had a church to build at home. And he knew that the best way to gather interest and funding for the church he was going to build was to acquire an important relic for the construction. You get a relic, and you'd get some wealthy patrons who want to support you in your endeavor. So Hugh traveled to the north of France and visited a monastery where he heard that there was preserved there and on display the arm of St. Mary Magdalene. He was very pleased to hear this. He thought this would be a great relic to start his own church with. And so he convinced the monastery to give him a tour of the grounds and to show him at the end of the tour the arm of Mary Magdalene. When he was presented with the relic, he was so overcome with devotion that he leaned over to give the relic a kiss, showing his piety. And while his head was in the casket, he opened wide. And he decided that he would bite off a piece of Mary Magdalene's arm to bring with him back to England. When he was caught doing this, he didn't get away scot-free, I should say. When he was caught doing this, his defense was, well, just this morning, in fact, we had all gone to Mass, and we ate the body of our Lord. We ingested what Catholics believe is the fully corporal presence of Jesus. And he said, if we can do that to our Lord, why shouldn't we do that to saints? They let him go with the relic. Very convincing. I had heard this story years back before I really started looking at relics in earnest, because it seems the kind of thing that happens once in the long history of these sorts of things. But I was surprised to discover that it has happened many times, in fact, just this sort of thing. 3 centuries later, very far from the north of France where Mary Magdalene's arm was bit, in the Indian city of Goa, where they have the remains of St. Francis Xavier, a Portuguese saint who was really in some ways the first Catholic saint to have worldwide reach. He was sent to India and then down as far as Sri Lanka and then to China, where he eventually died. And after he died off the coast of China, they tried to bury him. And each time they buried him, they discovered that his body wouldn't decay. Who is what was called an incorruptible saint. And so they decided, Let's bring him back to India, where he first began his life as a missionary, and we'll keep him there enshrined as an incorrupt saint. So in the city of Goa, where I visited for the writing of this book, there is a large silver and gold casket, used to be open to the air so the believers could walk by and pay their respects. But in the 16th century, there was one such procession by the body of the saint, and a Portuguese woman was so moved by her devotion to the saint that she, like Hugh of Lincoln, leaned into the casket, and this time she was kissing not an arm but a foot, and she bit off one of his toes. Ever since, St. Francis Xavier's body has been kept under glass. She did not get away with the toe, by the way. They had to put it back. But that was just the beginning of the corrupting of a body that they called incorruptible. Because of its sanctity, because of the devotion people had to it, a body that was prized for being all intact began to be cut into pieces because they thought, if we have one incorruptible body, that's great, but if we have all these pieces of incorruptible bodies, wouldn't it be great to send all around the world? And so St. Francis Xavier was slowly cut into little bits and sent all around the world as a way of multiplying his sanctity. And yet they still call him incorrupt. When you look at the body now, he's clearly not all there. And yet they will, the Jesuits who wash over him will tell you, here is the incorrupt body of St. Francis Xavier. I don't want to give the impression that this is only a bit of Christian strangeness. It's a practice you find in all faith traditions in various ways. And it's an example. 2,000 years before Francis Xavier died and had his toes bitten apart, the Buddha died, for example. And the Buddha was not one himself for suggesting that relics were a good way to practice religion because, after all, the Buddha is all about impermanence, preaching that nothing stays. And so the idea that a relic is possessing a relic is possessing a piece of eternity would have been puzzling to him. And yet he recognized that not everyone, not all of his followers, would see things the same way he did. So he decided that if it was useful to his disciples, to his monks, to have little bits of him after he died, well, that would be fine. And so he charged one of his monks with the responsibility after he was cremated, to sort through his remains and collect whatever was left and distribute them to the community for the sake of doing exactly what was done with St. Francis Xavier, for multiplying holiness, for making sanctity portable, for it not only to be connected to one man and one story, but for it to become something that can spread all over the world. Well, the monk who was charged with this very important mission apparently thought that he was due a commission. Because as he was distributing the ashes and the bone and the teeth and whatever was left of the Buddha, he decided that he would keep a little bit for himself. He took a tooth of the Buddha's and he put it in his hat. But apparently, according to legend, the Buddha's renown was such that it was not only on this world that people wanted pieces of him. The gods in their high heavens also looked down on the Buddha's remains and thought, that would be useful. I would like a little piece of that. And so when one of the gods in the high heavens saw this tooth hiding out in a monk's hat, the tooth shot up into the air, up through the clouds, never to be seen again. Hearing these kinds of legends, I am struck by the craziness of it. I mean, what is it about these objects that can make people behave in such unexpected ways? What it is about relics particularly that can lead people to do things that are not only seemingly barbaric, but also occasionally against the very creed of their religion? Well, to me, one explanation of what these things do is found in the technical term for what is used when a relic is moved. When you have an occasion where such as a bishop who finds or bites or steals a piece of a relic and brings it back to his church, it's actually called, in the technical sense, a translation because of the original meaning of translation, which is to carry a cross. And as anyone who's read my previous books, particularly my novel, Songs for the Butcher's Daughter, you'll know that I have a bit of an interest in translation. And translation in that sense is about the, obviously, the movement of a text from one language to another. Again, it's the kind of carrying across. And so looking at these stories, I began to wonder, is it just an accident of language that we have this same word for these two types of acts, these two very different physical acts, one, the transference of meaning from one language to the next, one, the transference of an actual body part from one building, from one church to another. And what occurred to me is that really they are telling the same kinds of stories. I mean, they are both about the movement of significance from one context to another. And to me, that was intriguing, because as a writer, as someone who's made his career writing about religion now, I realized that that is what I do. That is what I try to do. I try to be a translator of religious phenomena. I try to be one who is able to explain religion to the non-religious, and I hope non-religion to the religious. And I think that all of this grows out of the fact that I am someone from a very strong background of religious devotion, if not a particular practice myself. Anyone who knows my first book, my story about my parents, I have a somewhat unorthodox but also very traditional Catholic background. And I think because of that, I've become sort of spiritually bilingual. I understand doubt, and I understand skepticism, and I have taken it upon myself to explain each to the other. So with that in mind, I saw relics. I saw the practice of venerating relics as being a real test of my ability to be a translator of religious ideas. Because here we have something that is, on the face of it, a very strange religious belief. And if we can explain this kind of religious belief, can we explain all religious belief? If we can make sense of this apparently occasionally barbaric way of approaching religion, are we able to understand all religious phenomena in a new way? And so what I set out with this book to do was to find a way to return this act, which I think that we can very easily look at as being very far removed from our modern experience, and find a way of seeing it as basically human, to think of it as something prior to religion rather than something that is a function of religion. And indeed, in the research that I did for this book, I found that, of course, that there are things that look like relic veneration, not only in every religious tradition, but outside of religious tradition as well. One of the most interesting things I learned, in fact, is that there have been studies of the great apes. And apes in mourning have been known to need to see. This is a study actually done of apes in captivity. And if an ape gets sick and dies in captivity, if the ape is taken out of the zoo, for example, and the other apes don't see the body, they don't know what has happened, nothing will be right in the ape community. And so there is a need, even prior to religion, prior even perhaps to human experience, there is a need to be physically aware of the bodies of those we have lost and to think about them, not to ignore the fact that we have lost. And so what draws me to relics particularly is that they allow us to think about religion in a very physical way. I think that we often allow ourselves to reduce religious ideas to only the spiritual, to only the idea that it is only about what comes next or what comes before, and to ignore the fact that much of religious phenomena is very much about this world and this life and the bodies we live in. And for me, there is no better way to contend with those ideas than to recognize that our bodies ourselves can become religious objects. It's something that comes up again and again in the book is that we often don't know, really, who the bodies are who become religious relics. We don't know if the finger of John the Baptist, for example, which I saw in Italy. It's all there, by the way. It's a full finger. It has skin. It has quite a nicely manicured fingernail, but we don't know if that is the very finger that, according to Scripture, pointed at Jesus and said, this is the man. But to me, what is all the more interesting is, if it's not his finger, then whose? who lived a full human life all their own, only in death to be mistaken for John the Baptist, and to spend something close to eternity being confused with a saint? Those are the stories that are as interesting to me as the stories that from which relics draw their significance, which are the stories from Scripture. I'm interested in the human lives that that revolve around these objects, both in death and in life. And so that's all basically a preamble for what the book is. And what the book is it's my attempt to construct a full human body of relics, basically. Chapter by chapter, I started with the toes I mentioned of St. Francis Xavier, and then I move up through the body, finding bits and pieces of saints from different traditions. Piecing this together is a way of thinking about the religious significance of the body, but also the religious significance of human lives, whether or not we believe, no matter what we believe. And so it's important to me that the book is about all religious traditions. I mentioned mainly Christian relics, but I traveled to places where there are Christian relics, where there are Buddhist relics, where there are Muslim relics. Hindus and Jews often insist that they don't have relics, but in practice, relics have become such a powerful symbol that I found that even religious traditions that as a rule do not have relics because of the ways they regard the body and death, even in those traditions, I've found that you can find something that looks very much like a religious relic. How are we doing? I would like to read just a couple pages of you of a chapter for you, and then I'd love to have some questions, which I think through your questions we can get at where I went and what I saw. So if I could, I will just read just a couple pages just to give you a flavor for the book. Of all the places I went, the place that I was most nervous about going was Kashmir in the northern region of India, because it's as you all know, if you read the news, it's a place periodically gripped with violence. It's a dangerous place. Bill Clinton called it the most dangerous place in the world when he was there in the late 90s, and so going there specifically to see a relic seemed a very foolhardy thing to do. It wasn't. I'm not a war correspondent. I write about religion, so it seemed a risky thing to do. But when I was there, it was at a moment of calm, and it struck me as one of the most fascinating places I visited while I was traveling. So I'm just going to read you. I think it's two-ish pages. It is the custom in Kashmir to sit a guest upon the floor, drape him in blankets, and then give him a burning basket of coals to hold between his legs. Kangri, as this basket is called, is not just a basic of Kashmiri etiquette. It is the most common means of personal heating in a place subject to glacial temperatures and power outages that can last for weeks. When not in the nervous hands of visitors, kangri baskets can most often be found beneath the folds of a faran, the traditional ankle-length woolen cloak worn throughout the six-month Himalayan winter by women and men alike. Acting as a sort of walking chimney for the smoldering coals underneath, farans are known for their broad shoulders, sturdy stitching, and burn holes near the waist. Sitting in the walk-in freezer of an entertaining room of the man whose family has guarded Kashmir's most sacred relic, a hair from the chin of the Prophet Muhammad, for eight generations, I tried to keep my kangri steady between crossed legs. But one of my feet has fallen asleep, throwing off my balance. I lean the smallest bit forward to return circulation to my extremities without drawing attention to the hand rubbing my foot, and that only makes it worse. My foot still feels nothing, but the rest of my lower half is not so lucky, as smoking kangri coals spill into my crotch. All of this is hidden from my hosts beneath the blankets layered over my lap. I'm in Srinagar, a mostly Muslim city in which hospitality is the true religion, a terrible irony given how much holy killing has gone on here. And so the last thing I want to do is jump up screaming that the coals have made the zipper of my jeans as hot as a frying pan. More tea? The guardian of the relic asks. By your face, it seems you need something, yes? His name is Muhammad Bush. Over his farin, he wears two thick blankets. Topped off by a knit cap, he pulls down to the wrinkles that give the skin around his eyes a resemblance to drought-cracked earth. Well past 70, he is the son, grandson, and great-grandson of the relic's former guardians, one of whom looks down at me from a life-size portrait that is the room's only decoration. The man in the painting wears a green turban and a purple cloak. He stares with the intensity of one who knows the future of a sacred object will be the responsibility of the fruit of his loins. Mr. Bush, meanwhile, has a much sadder gaze, one that knows the line will stop with him. His son, a tall and thoughtful 40-year-old, sits by his side. So the problem is not want of an heir. The problem is that the relic now has a new set of guardians, Indian soldiers. Sent a decade ago to keep the peace, they now seem here to stay. When I was a boy, Mr. Bush says, with a grandfather's smile, it was my job to walk around the shrine and knock the snow off the roof, and not only the snow. His son seems to take this line of talk as polite acknowledgement of the bitter chill of the room. The younger man rises and slides through the curtain that keeps the sitting area from the rest of the house, where the women of the family remain for the duration of my visit. He returns with a glowing kangri basket for his father, who slides it into the folds of his farin without a word. Many winters, Mr. Bush continues, there were long sticks of ice. They hung from the eaves of the roof to the ground, with points on the end. Do you know what I mean? Long sticks of ice, I ask? Yes, you have seen such in your travels? You mean icicles? Icicles, he repeats, a grin coming as he forms the sound. There is a word in English for these? He looks to his son with raised eyebrows, as if I have just mentioned something newfangled about which the younger man should have informed him. Icicles, he says again, enjoying the feel of it on his lips. A fine word. He seems to make a mental note of it. His English is impeccable but incomplete. It is among many educated residents of Srinagar, school-learned, spoken crisply and elegantly, yet pocked with holes. Nearly everyone in Kashmir knows words like militancy and occupation, but some more mundane words have either never appeared or fallen through the cracks. Learning a new one apparently delights him. Yes, I would walk around the shrine with a stick like a long cricket bat, he says, and knock these icicles to the ground. I do not know if the shrine any longer has such icicles. Perhaps the soldiers break them with their guns. Mention of the soldiers, the new guardians of the relic, emerges every few minutes in the conversation, as if Mr. Bush would rather not mention them, but can't help himself. The soldiers are the reason his family no longer lives at the Hazratbal Shrine, the holiest Muslim site in Kashmir. It is because of the soldiers that he no longer wakes to views of the vast Dal Lake with the Himalayas rising like the arched back of a cat behind it. It is because of the soldiers that the shrine itself, its white dome shining like a second moon at night, has changed its meaning. The shrine, the relic, and the soldiers together are part of what makes Kashmir both heaven on earth, as it has often been called, and the most dangerous place in the world. When I was young, many things were different, Mr. Bush says. No doubt the winters were just as cold, but his memories seem of warmer times. The part of the story that I didn't mention and I get to is that this relic also, like the relics I mentioned earlier, the finger of Mary Magdalene that was bit off by Hugh of Lincoln, the toe of St. Francis Xavier that was bit off by a pious Portuguese woman, the tooth of the Buddha that was tucked into the hat of a zealous monk. This relic, too, was stolen. It was stolen not centuries ago or millennia ago like the other relics, but it was stolen in the 1950s. And it was just one of many times in the relic's life when it has been the object and the cause of political violence. And that's something I found wherever I went looking at relics, that these potent symbols are not merely religious symbols, but political symbols. They become, in the places where they reside, objects of identity. And as such, they become targets for anyone who wants to challenge that identity. And so it was never... it was never discovered who stole this relic in Kashmir. India said Pakistan stole it. Pakistan said India stole it, and just for the sake of riling up the crowds. And when the relic was returned about a week after it was stolen, mysteriously, it just showed up at the doorstep. Everyone tried to ignore the question of whether it was the real thing. It's just a hair, after all, and it would be very easy if someone put it back under the glass. The guardian keeper of the relic, he was aware of the question of whether or not it was real. And when I asked him if he thought it was genuine, he just nodded and said, "Oh yes, yes, I'm very sure it's the very same holy relic." It was as if he knew to question it was to question the role his family had played for eight generations. And even as that role had been removed from his family, it was to question everything that they had lived their lives for. And so while focusing on relics naturally leads me to a lot of medieval history, a lot of medieval Christian history, and a lot of even older history of other religious traditions. Time and again, I found that these ancient religious histories intersect with our modern concerns, our most pressing concerns. It's not just in Kashmir that a relic has been a center of violence. In Sri Lanka, for example, where I also visited, around the same time that the Kashmiri insurgency was happening, a suicide bomb drove into the temple of the Buddha's tooth. And so what I find compelling about these objects is that we feel so removed from them. We feel so removed from this part of our religious history that it's easy to make light of them. They seem rather silly sometimes when we talk about them. For example, I have a chapter on the foreskin of Jesus Christ. It usually gets a laugh. And yet that relic, like all the other relics I write about, have been the subject of very real conflict. And so I think that my overall project with this book is uncovering these elements of our shared religious history and finding ways in which that these objects, in their common humanity, in their very personness, thinking about them might help us find ways to heal the conflicts between religious traditions. It's almost as if finding out that we all do strange things may help us get along a bit better together. And I'm not entirely confident that we can do that, because no matter how strange your practices seem, the other person's always seem a bit stranger. And my experience writing the book has left me overall hopeful about the people I met in each place, and the people for whom relics are at the center of their lives, and yet the prospect of such objects remaining at the center of conflicts leaves me much less optimistic. And so I think that what I hope to happen with the book is just that we will be able to think about what is to come of religion in a new way by thinking about where we have been, to not neglect these darker moments of our shared human history, and really, if not to embrace them, if not to be so moved by devotion to relics that we find ourselves leaning in and taking a big bite, at least to be aware that they are part of our shared human history.
If the Catholic Church authenticates relics for Catholicism, who's authenticating them for these other religions?
It's a good question, and it works in different ways. And not every tradition has this kind of authentication process, and not every relic looks the same in each tradition. I should say that Buddhist relics, while they do include things like Buddha's teeth and other odds and ends of other Buddhist sages, they also can be found in a much different form, which is that when cremation happens in the Buddhist context, what is sometimes done for people who are recognized as having lived particularly holy lives is that the ashes are sifted, in fact, looking not for teeth or pieces of bone, but for jewels. The idea is in the Buddhist context that if you have lived a holy life, when you are cremated, something called cremation jewels will be formed, and you will find little, basically like little gemstones. In the book, I say that they look a bit like pop rocks. They're little sugar crystals, and you'll find these, or they claim that you'll find these in the remains of particularly holy people, and those are recognized as relics whenever they're found. And sometimes those objects, if they are found in a life that had not been recognized as particularly holy, will lead the faithful to say, ah, well, this is a saint and we never knew about this person. And so it's a kind of, it's almost as if relics help them recognize the saint rather than the saint helping them recognize the relic.
Frequently, when flipping through the channels, I come across a channel that runs a story about a body being found in the Holy Land.
Yep.
Right. Of the historical time of Jesus. Who owns the bodies, and does it become a political issue?
That's a great question. In Israel, in the Holy Land, Israel owns the bodies. The state of Israel owns the bodies, and I think that it's no political issue because they've answered it. by fiat of the state. I mean that they take very seriously the issue of ownership of archaeological remains. It would certainly be a very different issue if you find a body in disputed territory, and a much more volatile issue, I suppose. But oftentimes, I think that it's I know in Israel as well as in India that there are state sponsored archaeological agencies that take possession of the bodies and then carry on with their procedures. In much the same way, I know that the Smithsonian, for example, may oversee bodies that are discovered here. But the actual ownership of the body remains a good question, and I think that it is a kind of a gray area, because though an archaeological agency has responsibility of oversight of the research done on those types of remains, what eventually happens to them, I think, it is often disputed, and I don't have a solid answer for you. But yes, they are. You'll hear in the news that they're finding Jesus' second cousin twice removed, and they need to figure out, who owns him. Oh yes, definitely. And I think then there's all kinds of second tier jockeying for who gets to do the research and who gets to publish about it and who gets to sell the National Geographic special.
How often do the more commonly accepted relics ever get sort of disproven or disqualified or found to be fake, or is that something that most of the keepers try to prevent from happening because there's so much, they have so much at stake if it found that way?
That's a great question, and a good question to end with, because it allows me to talk about what is probably the most famous relic. And though in the book I focus on bodily relics, I do have rag in the title. It's not just bones. And so I should mention that the probably the most argued over, most often authenticated and disauthenticated relic is the Shroud of Turin. And the Shroud of Turin is a fake, frankly, and I think that everyone recognizes that. Anyone who has studied it recognizes it now, and through the years of its history, it's a very old fake. It has historical interest, if only for that reason. And through the years of its history, it has been it's been picked over and photographed and studied in all kinds of ways. But it's also been treated very in ways you wouldn't expect for a relic that people were trying to figure out its real provenance. It was vacuumed once, for example. an odd detail I picked up along the way. But what's interesting to me, the short answer is not very often. Only with something as high profile of the Shroud of Turin, and only very rarely do they do that. And then the interesting thing to me is that even once it is shown, something like that is studied and is shown basically without a doubt that it is not what people say it is, believers don't care. It doesn't matter at all to them. And it's not because the people who believe in it and go to see it and venerate it, it's not because they are ignorant of science or don't have logical minds. It's because I think they are self-consciously engaged in an act of devotion, and the human mind is complicated enough to do contradictory things, I think, to recognize that the reality of this object is what I bring to it and what my faith brings to it. And it's a different question than whether or not this piece of cloth wrapped the body of Jesus, for example. And I think that that's bound to happen with any relic that is put up for that kind of authentication. It's only those who don't have particular use for them in the first place who really want to see it debunked, you know. And to me, that is the debunking or the disauthentication of something is it's interesting because it adds a new layer of history to it, but it doesn't stop making something an interesting historical object. And for me, most of all, as someone who was after the stories of the lives that revolve around these objects, it doesn't change those stories at all. It makes them all the more intriguing to me that they are able to have a complicated relationship with something like that. Thank you. Thank you all. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour, and we want to let you know that Book Tour will no longer be available on a weekly basis, but it will be an occasional series. Podcast subscribers don't need to make any changes. Future readings will download automatically when published.